is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
It was quite a reasonable step given the circumstances, and also looking at the plea by various groups that we cannot continue this way. We have to allow the economy to begin to function so people can fend for themselves.
That's South African political analyst Ralph Matega on the decisions to ease the country's lockdown. Details coming up also. At least 22 people were killed in a new round of Al-Shabaab-related violence in Somalia. And recent jihadist attacks in Mozambique has brought the country's security situation to the forefront. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, here's our top story. South Africans will wake up tomorrow with almost all restrictions to economic and social life removed after President Cyril Ramaphosa announced the lockdown is being eased. The decision has brought huge excitement to the populace and great relief to businesses that were on the verge of collapse. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
In his address Saturday, Ramaphosa announced sweeping changes to the restrictions imposed to fight the COVID-19 pandemic. Starting Tuesday, gym lovers will be back at the treadmills to shed extra weight accumulated during lockdown that began 4 months ago, was eased briefly, then reimposed as cases spiked. Nature enthusiasts will be heading to their favorite parks and beaches. Citizens will now be able to visit families and hold small gatherings without being bothered by the police. Almost all businesses have the green light to operate at full scale. But it is the decision on drinking and smoking that seems to have brought a lot of joy.
Restrictions on the sale of tobacco will be lifted. The suspension of the sale of alcohol will be lifted, subject to certain restrictions. Alcohol will be permitted for on-site consumption in licensed establishments only up to 10 p.m.
Sibangani Mgadi from Diageo South Africa, the country's leading spirits company, explains why this is great news.
The industry itself employs or supports more than 1 million jobs. And in that regard, we are happy that at least we have an opportunity to save most of those jobs. With the first lockdown, we lost about 120,000 of those. But we are really, really grateful for the opportunity to be able to trade.
The tourism sector was also a large beneficiary of the announcement, with hotels now able to open their doors to everybody. Sporting activity will also resume, but with no spectators present. Political analyst Ralph Matega says the ban on a number of economic activities was no longer sustainable.
It was quite a reasonable step given the circumstances, and also looking at the plea by various groups that we cannot continue this way. We have to allow the economy to begin to function so people can fend for themselves.
The easing of restrictions comes at a time when the number of infections is edging towards 600,000, with almost 12,000 deaths. Professor Salim Abdul Karim, chairperson of the COVID-19 Ministerial Advisory Committee, explains why they advised the government to ease restrictions despite these huge figures.
We're seeing quite clear trends that show a decline. And ideally, we'd like to see about 14 days of decline, and that's certainly been the case for the entire country and most of the provinces. And so the decline is quite clear.
He, however, cautioned against early celebration, saying complacence could trigger a surge in infections. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
At least 22 people were killed in new round of violence in Somalia in the past 24 hours involving the Al-Shabaab militant group. Officials say an attack yesterday evening on the beachfront hotel of Mogadishu killed 12 people and injured 42 others. Five attackers were also killed. Officials and witnesses told VOA Somali service that a suicide car bomb exploded outside the elite hotel of Mogadishu's popular Lido Beach. Moments later, four armed gunmen stormed the hotel. Ismail Mukhtar, a spokesperson for the Ministry of Information, said they were shot dead after security forces arrived at the scene. More than 200 people were rescued. In the town of Belid Hawo, close to the border with Kenya, at least 6 people were killed and 8 others were injured after an explosion at a restaurant in the town's busy livestock market this afternoon. In addition, a district official and a police officer were among 4 killed in the town of Gofudud Biore, 20 miles west of Baidoa, when Al-Shabaab militants attacked a military base using a suicide car bomb. The recent jihadist attack in Mozambique put the country's security situation at the top of the agenda for the Southern Africa Development Community's annual summit. Leaders from 16 South African countries expressed solidarity and commitment to support Mozambique. Nicolas Pinot reports from Paris for VOA.
The leaders met virtually due to coronavirus travel restrictions as Mozambique takes over the rotating chairmanship at the time of another attack from the jihadists. The 40th SADC summit is committed to support Mozambique, according to a final statement, and condemned all acts of terrorism and armed attacks. This came after an occupation of a strategic port in Mozambique's province of Cabo Delgado, which borders Tanzania. This province has been ravaged by the jihadist insurgency since 2017, but the government waited until April to admit the presence of the so-called Islamic State militants in the country. In May, SADC security unit pledged to help Mozambique tackle the insurgency, one of the toughest challenges Southern Africa has faced in recent years. But concrete action has yet to be seen. In a pre-summit meeting on Thursday, Mozambique Foreign Minister Veronica Makamo spoke of the need for consultation and coordination of our actions in combating terrorism, which poses a major threat to our region. SADC set up a standby brigade in 2008 to respond to conflict situations. The force was deployed to restore security in Lesotho in 2017 following the killing of the kingdom's top army commander. If sent to Mozambique, it will be the first time it faces terrorism. SADC will meet again next year for a face-to-face summit in Maputo. Nicolas Pinot for VOA News, Paris.
African Union-sponsored negotiations on the Grand Renaissance Ethiopian Dam have stalled again amid disputes over the rights to the water from the Nile based on old treaties and even alleged divine rights. The Nile and its tributaries flow northward in East Africa through Ethiopia, Sudan, and Egypt until the Mediterranean. However, Ethiopia insists that the Nile belongs to it even after the river leaves its territory. Hamdi Abdelrahman, professor of political science at Cairo University, spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawi about culture differences that have contributed to the lack of progress in negotiations.
We are always talking to the Nile as if a technical issue, but you need to go to the culture of the people, how the Ethiopian perceive the Nile. They never call it the Nile. They call it in Amharic, Abai. Abai in Amharic is the father of all Niles, and they believe it is a divine. Even in the Old Testament, it was mentioned that this one of the four rivers came from the heaven. So in the folklore, the famous songs in Ethiopia, believing in that this is our Nile, this is our Abai, and even Abiy Ahmed, in official statements, they never mention Blue Nile. They call it Abai. This is our Abai. And it is no wonder that the Ethiopian foreign minister, in many occasions, calling this is our lake, this is our water, and we have all rights to use our own water. But what is the implication of this kind of belief on the negotiation? I think there is a problem here in the terms of reference, because we consider in the two other riparian states that the Blue Nile is an international river. But for the Ethiopian, they believe it is a transboundary river. It is an Ethiopian river, goes beyond their own border. So it is a part of our generosity. We are not going to cause any harm to you?
From a legal point of view, Abdurrahman said Egypt and Sudan rely heavily on treaties signed with Britain in 1929 and 1959, allocating specific huge amounts of Nile water to both countries. But Ethiopia was not a party to either agreement.
You come to Ethiopia, they consider this as a colonial era treaty. It is an injustice, so we cannot follow it. So we need to negotiate on a new one. So is there any legal basis for this? Yes. When you come to the international law, there is always a gray area in the international law. It is not very definite. There is a theory calling a clean slate. It decides that the colonial treaty is not binding toward the new states. Only in Africa, it is binding regarding borders. But out of the borders, they say, no, it is optional for these countries to follow these treaties or not. So Ethiopia prefer as a clean slate theories, and Egypt believe in the successions of treaty.
Because of the cultural and legal gaps separating Ethiopia from Egypt and Sudan, the professor expects protracted, complicated negotiations unless the three countries come to some sort of compromise. That was Hamdi Abdurrahman, professor of political science at Cairo University, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawi. New findings released today show an alarming spike in attacks against humanitarian workers last year, including in parts of Africa's Sahel region. French and Nigerian nationals were killed there last week in one of the latest attacks, as Lisa Bryant reports from Paris.
En prenant la parole devant ces six cercueils alignés,
France held a memorial ceremony Friday for six aid workers killed in Niger on August 9th, along with two Nigerians. It was one of a pair of strikes against French humanitarian workers last week. Last Monday, another was gunned down in Guatemala. The Niger attack took place in a nature reserve outside the capital, Niamey, an area once considered safer than most other parts of the country. But the Sahel region overall is becoming increasingly violent. French troops are working with regional counterparts to fight an Islamist insurgency. It's not the only area of concern. Worldwide, last year marked the highest number of major attacks against aid workers over the past decade, with 483 workers killed, kidnapped, and wounded, according to independent research group Humanitarian Outcomes. Report co-author Abby Stoddard is a former humanitarian worker.
Even though there are attacks in dozens of countries, only a handful of the worst conflict environments have, you know, numbers in the double and triple digits, and those really drive the total.
Along with years-long hotspots like Afghanistan, Syria, South Sudan, and Somalia, there are also some newcomers, like Mali, right next to Niger, from where the Sahel insurgency spread. Speaking on French radio last week, Vincent Couchetel, a high-level official with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, agreed aid workers are increasingly becoming targeted in the Sahel and elsewhere. Couchetel himself spent nearly a year as a hostage in the Caucasus region in the 1990s. In and around the Sahel, the humanitarian community is reeling from a spate of recent deadly attacks. Along with the Niger killings, two aid workers were killed in Cameroon. Another five were executed after being abducted by alleged extremists in northeastern Nigeria's Borno state. As these attacks become deadlier, they also reflect a frightening new normal. Conflicts once pitting countries against each other are now increasingly splintered, involving a tangle of armed groups which no longer see aid workers as neutral or beneficial.
They are associated often with the enemy, so they're seen as legitimate targets, right? So they don't have a moral issue with targeting them. But it also allows them to flex their muscles and exercise control over local populations by controlling where the aid goes.
Stoddard says attacking aid workers also brings economic benefits. Assailants gain vehicles, humanitarian relief, and cash, including through hostage ransoms.
Charline, Nadifa, Miriam, Stella.
Stoddard and others say aid groups are responding by taking more precautions and adopting new strategies to reduce operating risks. But there is no such thing as zero risk. And in Niger and elsewhere, there are sometimes terrible outcomes. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The South African government has joined the growing list of those condemning human rights abuses in Zimbabwe and saying that there is a crisis in the country. Adigando gives us more on the story.
Nalendi Pando, South Africa's international relations minister, says their government thinks there is an undeniable political crisis in Zimbabwe, which is also affecting her country. Zimbabwe's government, however, says there is no crisis in the country. Over the past several years, Zimbabweans have poured into South Africa due to the economic meltdown and political instability in the country. Rights organizations such as Human Rights Watch estimate that there are more than 2 million Zimbabweans who are eking out an existence in South Africa. In the past few days, the Zimbabwe Catholic Bishops' Conference, ZCBC, issued a pastoral letter joining the international outcry against human rights abuses in Zimbabwe. The Bishops' Conference and rights groups allege the government has used abductions, beatings, torture, and incarceration to silence journalists and critics as the government has reacted to the social media Zimbabwean Lives Matter campaign. The bishops later said Zimbabwe is in a multi-layered crisis of the convergence of economic collapse, deepening poverty, food insecurity, corruption, and human rights abuses. Zimbabwe's information minister, Monica Mchangwa, responded to the letter.
As the government of Zimbabwe, we vehemently object to and strongly condemn the pastoral letter of Archbishop Lobo and his coterie of Catholic prelates. Its evil message reeks with all the vices that have perennially hobbled the progress of Africa. They were in generalized and baseless accusations. Absolutely no shred of reported evidence of so-called victims of human violations.
The government accused the bishops of wanting to fan ethnic tensions in the country. The African Union Commission also has condemned the deteriorating human rights situation in the country. The AU Commission Chair, Musa Faki Mahamat, last week issued a statement spotlighting the Zimbabwe situation and expressing deep concern about the plight of citizens in the country. Zimbabwe's Foreign Affairs Minister, Sibusiso Moyo, responded that there was no evidence of a crisis warranting the regional body's message, which he says breached the principle of subsidiarity. Socio-political analyst Alex Magaisa weighs in on the Zimbabwe government's rebuttal of what it calls foreign intervention in its internal affairs.
But the rules of international law have undergone significant changes in recent decades, and it is necessary to appreciate that there are grounds and there are avenues by which, you know, other nations may intervene in the affairs of another state. For example, the responsibility to protect, for example, when there are, you know, crimes against humanity being committed within that state, and the people need protection.
Magaisa says the recent South African response is notable and welcome given the two countries' economic ties. Zimbabwe has depended on South African goods in the wake of the collapse of its own manufacturing base over the past two decades.
South Africa has considerable leverage over Zimbabwe, economic leverage over Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe is very much dependent on South Africa, you know, for its, you know, various, you know, economic needs. And it's important for South Africa not only to recognize that, but for Zimbabwe to realize that that economic pressure can be used, you know, against the rogue regime. We have seen this. We have precedents from the days of Rhodesia, Ian Smith, dealing with South Africa. The reason, one of the reasons why the war ended the way it did, was that South Africa was now applying pressure on the regime of Ian Douglas Smith.
Magaisa and other analysts say external pressure could encourage Zimbabwe's government to reform. Zimbabwe's economy has been a long decline, with inflation at over 700% a year and shortages of basic goods ranging from fuel to medicine. The ruling ZANU-PF party also faces rising unhappiness over alleged corruption. Last month, security forces shut down plans for a major demonstration against corruption, and detained scores of people involved in organizing. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Bulawayo.
Beyoncé's latest surprise drop, Black is King, is gaining both fans and detractors around the world for its dazzling, colorful, sumptuous portrayal of African culture. But in South Africa, where her crew filmed several scenes of the 85-minute musical feature, viewers and those who participated in the production say it is an important part of an emerging narrative. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Black is King stunned Beyoncé fans when it dropped suddenly last month. The visual album, which was filmed last year in the U.S., South Africa, West Africa, and Europe, is based on music from her album, The Lion King, The Gift, and features an array of African artists, musicians, and dancers. Like all Beyoncé products, this album has its detractors. Some accuse the Houston native of cultural appropriation for using African aesthetics. But in South Africa, where she filmed many of the scenes, those involved in the production were rapturous. Sibusiso Matebula worked on some Johannesburg-based scenes as part of his film studies. He spoke to VOA via Google Hangouts from his hometown, Middelburg. Reaction is coming slowly from the continent because the film's distributor, Disney Plus, is not widely available here. But South Africa's largest cable distributor aired the film days after it debuted in late July and is making it available on demand for premium subscribers. Beyoncé fan Kosi Motswane, who founded a project to tell queer narratives in Africa, says he believes the African diaspora, which includes Black Americans, has every right to reference and use what some may see as African culture. He told VOA via Google Hangouts that he loved the film, but that doesn't mean he doesn't have a few critiques. And Motswane says it's important, especially now, to elevate the power and position of Black women, especially after U.S. Democratic Senator Kamala Harris became the first Black woman vice presidential pick. Matebula agrees and says Beyoncé's film inspired him to work on his own project that will help tell more African stories. On one thing, her African supporters agree. If Black is king, Beyoncé is the queen. So whether you're in Accra or Atlanta, they say, bow down. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
As Nigeria's COVID-19 cases continues to rise, the national government has directed federal civil servants to undergo tests for the virus as part of efforts to slow down the spread of the pandemic. From Abuja, Nigeria, Gifta Gariga has more.
The directive says the government has made available testing facilities where staff members experiencing COVID-19-related symptoms can get tested free. Those without symptoms also can get tested. Abubakar Ahasan Yakubu is the chairperson of the Nigeria Labour Congress, Abuja, and applauds the government's action.
It's all for the good of all of us, so that people get to work and they are very sure they are safe. And those colleagues of theirs in their work environment are also safe.
Yakubu, however, expressed doubts about whether the government can acquire enough testing kits to carry out the program.
I'm not sure even the quantum of workers at the federal level can all be tested. I'm not sure the federal government have the capacity to do that.
The government's directive on civil service employees makes no mention of whether private sector employees also will be able to get free tests. Dr. Austin Maho, a publisher and journalism teacher in Abuja, advised the private sector employers to imitate the federal government by ensuring their staff get tested.
I think the private sector should equally cater for their staff. I know that staff welfare is an integral part of the working condition in private sector. We are all in this together.
One civil servant, Abdul Fatai Bello, says the government should ensure that workers observe COVID-19 protocols when they come for the testing.
Being that all hands must be on deck to fight this scourge of COVID-19, steps must be taken to ensure that even while going for those tests, precaution is taken.
As Africa's biggest economy, the Nigeria government has imposed nationwide regulations to curtail the spread of the virus. For VOA News, this is Gift Agiriga from Abuja, Nigeria.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.